this month's podcast, JFY Networks continues our conversation with Hubie Jones. Hubie has not only witnessed Boston history for 67 years, but has also shaped and defined the civic and social landscape. He has been a leader in the formation, building, and rebuilding of at least 30 community organizations in neighborhoods across the city. Most recently, he founded the organization Higher Ground, which brings together multiple agencies and services to work together helping to solve urban issues. In this podcast, you'll hear Hubie's thoughts on what it takes to be a successful leader of an urban school system.
In terms of the individual being the kind of person who respects the other party, listens well, doesn't pontificate, and learns to change as they go through the working process together.
How local colleges and universities can help solve urban issues.
We have 350,000 students, college students, in the greater Boston community. Lots of faculty members. We have intellectual firepower that you couldn't believe. We're not putting it to use. We're not harnessing this intellectual firepower to solve civic problems in Boston.
And his thoughts on how improving urban schools is directly related to resolving other social issues.
Because if you can't address the need of people who are poor, working class, even near middle class, you're going to have the kind of community you're talking about. Class of people are basically pushed out, and you don't want that, particularly when you're in a multicultural world today that requires finding ways for people to live together of all classes, races, ethnicities. That's what's going to save the country.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized, self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeting unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Hubie Jones has been a mainstay in Boston politics and civic leadership since his arrival in 1955. During a recent conversation with JFY's executive director, Gary Kaplan, Hubie discussed how improving city schools is unequivocally connected to improving other aspects of city life as well.
Today, we're going to take on one of the large and intractable problems in the city. You've said more than once that Boston is on the cusp of becoming a great city, a world-class city, but it's not going to get there if the schools aren't great. So it seems like the most fundamental issue for the city as it starts to emerge as a global metropolis is how do we get the public schools great? And I think you might have an idea or two about how to do that.
Well, I think that we first have to be clear about a number of things. I know when I talk with you and seen some of the things you've written, Gary, you have said maybe one of the things we need with the size of the population of people who run the system is to bring in expert managers who could help us figure out how you deploy all of these people and what do they really cover in terms of getting the whole thing integrated. So that's one question. How helpful would people who know management be to help the school system try to figure out all this use of personnel? But that doesn't mean that you know how to put a system together that has the policies that would make the system work effectively and particularly support the staffing, and particularly the young staff who come in gung-ho and really want to do a job, and in 3 years they're gone because the conditions in the schools and particularly the policy mess just wears them out. and they burn out and they burn out. So that's a piece of what I think we have to get a handle on.
You've talked about a couple of kind of systemic things that that you think are would be important. One is the need for a partnership between the administration and the teachers union. Another is the power of the superintendent to make decisions within the district. But I think your emphasis on the need for a partnership between the administration and the teachers union is you know, a very interesting an interesting point.
Well, based upon what I know,
and you've seen some examples.
I've seen some examples. There was an example in Pittsburgh years ago where a man by the name of Richard Wallace came in to be the superintendent. And he developed a very strong partnership between himself and the union. They trusted each other. They understood each other's needs, okay? Of course, each other's have needs that they have to fulfill in order to in order for their constituencies to be happy with him. And based upon the fact that he had such a strong partnership, the Pittsburgh schools began to improve. And they got the, to a place nobody ever thought they would get to. So he was there about 9 years. Then after he left, it all went away slowly because the next person didn't have the kind of partnership that he had with the union.
So does it depend on the individual?
I think it in large measure does, in terms of the individual being the kind of person who respects the other party, listens well, doesn't pontificate, and learns to change as they go through the working process together. It takes people who do that, and people who have the idea that they want to build what I call a beloved community, where everybody really ends up caring about each other. Everybody ends up caring about the people who the system is built to serve.
Namely the kids.
Namely the kids.
So you were talking about that, about the school, what the school plant ought to look like. Well, you know, the buildings, the surrounding areas. And of course, one of the big issues in Boston is that so many of the school buildings predate, I think they predate the revolution.
They're obsolete.
So how important is that?
Mayor Walsh comes in and he says one of the things he's going to do is rebuild the schools. He's going to get the money from the state. He's going to get the money from the federal government. He starts down the road, and before he's yanked to Washington. But we're still not moving in that direction. You've got to have schools that are whose plans are excellent operationally, who are basically attractive, that are clean, okay, and that send a message to the kids. By having an environment like this, you care about them. They're worthy. The kids are worthy. Okay, you're validating their worthiness. And if in my judgment, the schools and public parks basically in some ways can be the oasis in the midst of a cruel, harsh urban landscape. And that's why it's important to have schools not only that work operationally, but that convey beauty, operational effectiveness, and caring about the kids. Yeah, we've lost what, 10,000 students recently?
In the past 11 years, we've lost 10,000 students. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we don't need some of these schools, just plain and simple. But we have a political problem. Some of the parents don't want the schools to go away anyway. Okay. Because they'll have to make a change about where they send their kids. Mm-hmm. So that's the political part of the problem. That's the political part of the problem. But it's got to be done.
But that's how do we get that? I mean, that is really the mayor's issue. The superintendent can't close a school. It's the mayor that has to.
Exactly. Yeah, the mayor's going to have to do it and use her power to do it, to get it done. Now, I think what I see with Mayor Wu is somebody who looked at a big problem brings together a very smart team that knows what to do or thinks they know what to do. And they put together a plan of action. Usually it's under the ground. And once she vets it and believes that it can work, she comes above ground and executes. Now, I think we're waiting to see with the schools in many ways, who are the people she's relying on to help her figure out how to change the Boston public schools and who will work with the union, okay, and the superintendent and the parents and ultimately her constituents to begin to move in the right direction.
Well, now parents,
parents.
How about that? How about the role of parents in the schools?
The role of the parents are paramount. They are paramount. They have to be, you know, they have to be listened to. Their needs have to be respected. They have to embrace what the principals and the teachers want to do. It's my feeling that there ought to be a school council in every school that is composed of parents, teachers, and administrators who decide on what kind of budget they should have, how to use that budget, what our priorities we collectively agree. There has to be that kind of partnership, that kind of collaboration. And the parents have to be at the core of this.
You have also talked about joy, the role of joy in education. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that you have to have within the schools things like the arts, music, plays, dance, which are joyous things that are a part of the learning process. Because if there's no joy in a school, if there's no joy in learning, then who's going to invest in it in any major way? And I think this is there's no debate about that.
When I look back on my illustrious career in public education, the things I remember about high school are the band, the chorus, and the theater department. I don't remember a single thing I ever learned in a classroom.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. What kept me, what brought me in every day was all those other things. The idea that schools should be joyous places or oases, as you're saying, I think that's a larger idea than the way that the dialogue has been conducted in recent years. Now, we've been talking, most of the discussion in recent years has been about STEM. We've got to get more kids into science, technology, engineering. Well, but there's very little discussion about getting more kids into music or art or theater. Now, how do we, in a period like this, when there's so much emphasis on test scores, on STEM, on linking high school to careers, which is fine. All of that is certainly necessary. But where is the discussion about these other things, about the arts?
Well, I founded the Boston Children's Chorus.
Yes, you did.
And the Boston Children's Chorus is the most joyous civic work I've ever done. The most joyous. This is the most joyous thing I've done. And the reason is joy is because it's brought together young people across the divides of race, ethnicity, social class, and sexual orientation, and become socially integrated, not desegregated, but socially integrated, and using the power of music to do that. The thing I get from these kids in the Boston Children's Chorus is that, first of all, we love being here, not just because of the music, because you run it in such a way that it's a loving community and we can talk about anything we want. If we want to talk about race in school, they shut us down. If we want to talk about mass incarceration, they shut us down. If we want to talk about...
Well, gender issues.
Gender issues. we've had male singers that turned to women, and have been embraced and so forth. Their feeling about the chorus is, we can talk about what we care about. We don't disagree with you. We don't agree with everything all the time, obviously, but we have civil discourse. Can't do it in regular schools.
So it's not just about the music.
Absolutely. We're using the power of music to make change in the community and to change the lives of kids. I told the kids, I don't care if you can sing like an angel. I don't care if you sing like an angel. But if you don't come out of here respecting men, young men, if you don't come out of here respecting women more than you did before you came in, then we failed. Okay?
Did you have that social agenda in mind when you started? And I remember the trip to Chicago, you know, where we saw the Chicago Children's Chorus, and you know, you said, we're going to do this in Boston. Did you have the whole social agenda in mind at that time?
The whole social agenda? Obviously not. But what I did know that I had tried to get social integration of kids through after-school programs, through camping, et cetera, et cetera, with limited success. And I was looking for a way to get it done effectively. And I was just at that point reading a lot about how the arts is one way you could bring kids together across divides and get integration. That was in my head as I heard the Chicago Children's Choir sing at a city year convention. They came on a stage, very diverse group of kids, mostly high school kids, singing at a level of excellence that blew me away. And I said, here's the model I've been looking for. Maybe this is it. 2 weeks later, I was in Chicago talking with the Chicago Children's Choir staff. How did you put this together? How do you know it's working? What are you doing in the schools? They took me to see the choirs they had in schools. I didn't think much of them, but they were trying to do it that way. But I learned a great deal about how this was. The power of all of this. So it was about building community in a different way than I had before through the use of music. That's all.
Well, another kind of aspect of building community that you've talked about is the idea of a metropolitan area delivery system. Boston, the surrounding communities, many of which are already linked through Metco, but not all of them. And then the universities. There's this whole kind of universe of resources surrounding Boston that has a lot to offer and a lot of ways for kids to connect with all kinds of things that they aren't necessarily going to run into in their school or in their neighborhood. What do you think the chances are of, you've talked about a multiple delivery system and a regional delivery system, including the universities, which of course are huge pools of resources. How do you think we might be able to tap into all of those things?
Well, at one point, there was an attempt to build an organization, it got off the ground, called EDCO.
Yeah. Oh, I remember EDCO. Yeah.
Remember EDCO?
Oh, yeah.
And this was going to bring together all of the metropolitan educational communities to really do things together, to share resources, to have kids go on field trips together from the suburbs as well as from the cities, to have the training of teachers together, so forth and so on. But it died.
When was that? Now, that was a long time ago.
Long time ago. It was in the late 60s, early 70s. There was an attempt to do that. How you do it, I don't know, but we do have the strongest, most enduring metropolitan educational system in the country. Metco being one part of it. You now have charter schools being a part of it. We need to think through whether this is a vision that should be pursued in the future. We have 350,000 students, college students, in the greater Boston community. Lots of faculty members. We have intellectual firepower that you couldn't believe. We're not putting it to use. We're not harnessing this intellectual firepower to solve civic problems in Boston. It is crazy. The university people, as far as I'm concerned, only think about how they can bring more foreign students here that have a lot of money and play a role in their financial success. They won't stand up and say anything, have a voice around major issues where they ought to have a voice. Now, I will say that during the desegregation of the schools, Garrity got brought in the colleges to play a role with the Boston Public Schools. And one of the presidents of one of the major universities here, who will be nameless, said, "Hubie, I'm pulling out of this partnership with the schools because they waste our time. I send my faculty over to work and they don't know what to do with us. And so I'm out of this."
Yeah.
Now, I'm not leaving publicly. Nobody's going to say I'm not being a good corporate person here.
Yeah.
A good citizen here. But in reality, we're not going to waste our time. And I apparently a lot of the universities feel that way. They don't want to be caught up in all kind of political nonsense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But hey, if I was 40 years old, I'd be starting a new organization that would be the Center for Community and University Collaboration. That's what I'd do.
That's what you'd be doing?
That's what I would be doing. If I was 40 years old, that's what I'd be doing.
Well, what would that organization do?
What it would do, it would get the universities to give sabbaticals to the faculty members who are very, very knowledgeable, skilled, to work on solving civic problems. It would get the students to be deployed with their faculty members and with community folks to solve community problems. Now, Mel King tried it with Boston College back in the 60s. I forgot what he called it, but he had faculty members coming in and working on the problems at that time. It just doesn't make any sense to let this tremendous resource not be used. Okay?
Well, maybe, you know, there's this early college initiative going on, you know, where high school students take college courses while they're still in high school. Maybe that can be the seed of a new wave of college high school partnership or collaboration, because the colleges, you know, the colleges are losing enrollment. They're not getting the high school students in the same numbers. They're not coming to college. All the colleges are down in enrollment, and they're also complaining that the
they're coming here from out of town. Boston University had 75,000 applicants last year. 75,000 applicants, what, for 2,700 seats?
Yeah.
Okay. Northeastern was in the same league.
So they don't need kids from Boston.
That's right. They need money. They need money. And some of this is about the way in which they get money.
Well, okay? full tuition paying foreign students.
Exactly.
So the colleges have no economic incentive to work with public schools to get more kids coming to college.
Yes, that's right.
So they'd have to be doing it out of, you know, social conscience, because they don't really have an economic interest. It would have to be social.
And that's what they need to have, a social conscience. They need to have a voice. Okay, I was speaking with a foundation person who was recently a college president, who said they won't say anything.
They meaning university people?
University leadership.
Won't say anything.
They have no voice on the major issues and problems that are confronting Boston. Okay?
And why is that?
I don't really know.
And is it like the old days, the old days when The Yankees didn't want to have anything to do with the Irish, and they just sort of abandoned municipal government, which is where a lot of the home rule issues still lingering originate. Is it something like that? We just don't want to deal with these people?
I don't know if that is that kind of thing. I think they're just so preoccupied with being great universities and seeing that as their major priority.
So, all right. So there's this whole narrative, this whole political narrative about the educated elite and the educated white collar elite and the blue collar working class ethnic populations splitting apart. And, you know, that's where you get the coastal idea, and the Democrats are all educated elites and the Republicans are now trying to appeal to working class blue collar folks. Is it part of that phenomenon? The universities don't want to get involved in difficult, intractable urban problems. They just want to do their research and get their foreign students coming in and provide a workforce for the high tech industry. Is that what it is?
That's how I see it. And if you see what's going on at MIT, incredible, this partnership between faculty and students to build technology companies. In fact, MIT calls itself the engine. Get clear now. We are the engine driving this new technology in this area. Basically, we're Silicon Valley East, and they have created a building, part of a building, which they call the engine, where faculty members and students, smart students, come together and they create new companies. Now, all of them don't succeed, but a lot of them do. And there's so many now over there in the Kendall area, they're spilling into Boston, okay, which is going to end up with basically building in the building boom in Boston. Is going to be a part of this building boom is going to lead to greater gentrification, and the cost of housing is going out of sight in Roxbury, in Mattapan, in Dorchester. I worry about that. I worry about the coming of serious gentrification here. And you're not going to be able to hold on to even middle-class people in the school system.
So it sounds like MIT is turning into Goldman Sachs as an incubator of enterprise, which would tend not to make them interested in getting involved in problems of urban public education. There's no new companies to be founded there.
That's right.
So is that what's going on? Their focus is going higher and higher up the economic ladder and making it less likely that they're going to have any interest in engaging in all these tricky and difficult urban issues.
Well, they're excited, and I can understand it, by the fact that they are solving problems that they care about.
So is it splitting? Is the success, the economic and technological success of the region, is that actually driving even more social stratification?
I think so.
So there's a lot of, impetus, a lot of movement at the high end. Meanwhile, you know, we've got 46,000 kids in the Boston public schools who don't have joyous places, welcoming oases, or even safe places to go to try to learn how to read and write. How do we mediate that huge split? Where does the impetus come from? You know, you have somebody like Mayor Wu who does have the right ideas. How is she going to make any inroads in these issues that we've been discussing? How is she going to do that?
Well, as you know, based upon the work I've done with Higher Ground, it was developed in order to build partnerships between all of these nonprofits in Roxbury, North Dorchester, Mattapan. At the time we started, there were 180 nonprofit organizations. Many of them needed to go away because they weren't doing anything. But there was some that were doing very important things. but they were solo in a very solo way. And because of that, the problems of young people and their parents in Roxbury, particularly, were getting worse. The outcomes were getting worse. So we said, what we need is not a new service organization. We need an organization to forge partnerships. So sharing information, sharing intelligence, et cetera, so we could solve big problems. And if we can't do that, we're cooked. Okay. Now, fortunately, one of the problems they're dealing with is getting homeless students housing, affordable housing, near the schools they go to, coming from hotels and motels outside of the city, and providing the families support of all kinds so they can thrive in this new circumstance. Now, we've done it with 500 families and individuals. Mm-hmm. It's a drop in the bucket, but it's a model that can work. It needs to be scaled across Boston, because there are 4,000 homeless students in the Boston public school system. You can have a stable school system with that kind of condition. Now, fortunately, we have some people, from Liberty Mutual and others who've given us money. Children's Hospitals have been fabulous. Yeah. And they're saying, let's bring the heavy hitters together now to get the money. The money is here to get the money and the resources to scale this model across course and solve this problem.
The money is here. There's no lack of money in this town.
Exactly. So that is a good thing. They're seeing the value of collective impact. If you don't get collective impact, you're going to be dribbling around here with service institutions that do a little bit of work, but that doesn't make a big difference.
The impact, as the scale isn't there.
Yeah, it's the scale. So anyway, so that's, we're on that course. We're now going to bring these heavy hitters together, and we will see if we can get the resources to do it straight across the system. Every urban school system in America has this problem. So we have a model that could not only benefit Boston, but could benefit other parts of the country. That's what we can do.
So do you think that Higher Ground is the model for addressing some of these major urban issues, the collaborative model?
Yeah, it's one of them. It's one of them. That's not the only one, but it's one of them. We've had a very strong board, very well-respected people who've been here a long time to live in the city, care about the city. That's what's given us success thus far. But we're now turning it over to a younger generation, and they're coming on the old leadership. I'm out now, and that's the way it should be. If we make the transition in the proper way, I think we'll be able to have sustainable progress going forward. We know we have to raise $9 million within a year to be sustainable. That's possible. Boston is, I say, on the cusp of greatness, because we have these extraordinary educational institutions here, extraordinary medical institutions here that are quite substantial. We have a built environment, which is pretty spectacular. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the human services infrastructure that's going to help save us. Because if you can't address the need of people who are poor, working class, even near middle class, you're going to have the kind of community you're talking about. Class of people are basically pushed out, and you don't want that, particularly when you're in a multicultural world today that requires finding ways for people to live together of all classes, races, ethnicities. That's what's going to save the country. I think coming out of this, the big question is, what kind of city do we want to be? We could become a city that loses the opportunity to be great, dealing with the needs of everybody, or we can just go in a way in which the elite, quote unquote, who are they are, drive us in the wrong direction. And it's in the hands of leaders, along with the people who support them, to get clear with them, get clear with themselves and understand what is ahead of us. It could be great. If we don't start acting now in certain leadership ways, it'll be too late to stop the unfortunate things that could happen.
Well, I think, Hubie, I think we've done enough for today. We've covered a lot of good ground. And let's see how this shapes up. And I think there might be another discussion we need to have. But right now, Hubie, thank you.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
We would like to thank Hubie Jones for joining us this month on the JFY Networks podcast. We plan to continue our conversation with him in the near future and hope you'll join us as he continues to share his experiences leading the campaign for racial and economic justice in the city of Boston. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.